Today, an archived presentation of a discussion about the theory and practice of nonviolence, according to Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi.
Been there, done that, or seen it on TV. Protesters sitting down in streets, occupying offices, chaining themselves to trees, chanting, singing, and determined to be nonviolent. They attend trainings and workshops where they learn how to link arms, how to behave when the police arrive, how not to be provoked when they're being roughed up, pepper sprayed, manhandled. We saw it in Seattle and D.C. Some of us witnessed it in the 60s. We've seen films about Mahatma Gandhi. And yet, what do we truly know about nonviolence, not just as a tactic of protest, but as a theory, a philosophy, a way of being? Do activists currently practice nonviolence in a way that Gandhi or Dr. King would approve of? Does it matter if nonviolence is used solely as a protest tactic? What are the limits to what it can achieve? I'm joined by two guests who know a lot about nonviolence theory and practice. Dennis Dalton is a longtime expert on Mahatma Gandhi. He teaches political science at Barnard College and is author of, among other things, Mahatma Gandhi, Nonviolent Power in Action. Also joining us is Claiborne Carson. He is a professor of history at Stanford University and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project there. Carson has written extensively about Dr. King and Malcolm X, and he is co-editor of the Papers of Martin Luther King Jr. And let me start with you, Dennis Dalton, and this concept of nonviolence that Gandhi practiced. When and how did Gandhi... Now, Gandhi began his career as a somewhat awkward, stumbling lawyer. When did he begin to develop his philosophy of nonviolent resistance?
He went to South Africa in 1893, and he went there originally not to practice nonviolence, but as a young, stumbling lawyer to make a reputation and make money. But then he faced the overwhelming discrimination against the Indian community in South Africa. And in response to that, he developed his method of nonviolent action. He started it in 1906 in a mass civil disobedience protest against the discrimination against the Indian community in South Africa.
Now, 1906, he was 37 years
That's
old
right.
by that time.
That's true. And he had intended, when he went to South Africa in 1893, to spend only a few years there, but he spent in all 21 years, not leaving South Africa until 1914. They went back to India and developed the method that he had first applied in South Africa. So it was later in life. He went through several stages of development. At first, he was a loyalist, totally taken by the way in which Britain administered its colony in South Africa and in India, and then later on developed this attitude of strong resistance to British imperialism.
And of course, nonviolence or ahimsa was a big part of that resistance. What were the sources, the origins of Gandhi's sense of nonviolence?
He was extraordinarily original. That is, he conceived of it in the midst of practice, the practice of the technique in South Africa. It wasn't until after he had developed the method in 1906 that he read Henry David Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, which ultimately helped him, influenced him to perfect it. But initially, he didn't get the inspiration from Thoreau. He got it from actually being involved in the practice of it in South Africa. He conceived of it as a method of nonviolent non-cooperation to non-cooperate with the abusive and discriminatory legislation of the racist regime in South Africa.
What about his Hindu religion, his Hindu upbringing? What principles from that religion and perhaps from also the Jain religion did he adopt, did he bring to bear onto a philosophy of nonviolence?
He was a nonviolent person. That is, his whole attitude towards society and self was nonviolent. You mentioned the idea of ahimsa, which is a classical ancient concept in Hinduism, meaning literally not violent. Himsa is violence, and ah is not, and so it's not being violent. However, this attitude of ahimsa had not been developed in a political sense in India before Gandhi developed it. It was an attitude that encouraged vegetarianism and not taking the life of anyone, but any being. But Gandhi developed it in the 20th century in a highly original way in the context of a political movement. And, of course, he called that political movement Satyagraha, and that was a name that he coined which meant literally holding on to truth and holding on to nonviolence. And as a result of the holding on tightly to truth and nonviolence, a force, and a new force, Gandhi said, was born. And that force needed to be applied to righting the wrongs of in society, the discrimination that existed against the blacks and Indians in South Africa.
And so this truth was a political truth based on a morality embedded in his Hindu religion?
Yes. Yes, it's certainly inconceivable that Gandhi would have developed this without his having been a Hindu. That was absolutely critical. But there had been many Hindus before Gandhi that had been involved in discrimination and had not come up with this idea of nonviolent non-cooperation, that is, resisting in this way. That was Gandhi's original contribution.
Dennis Dalton is a professor of political science at Barnard College. He has written extensively on Gandhi, and his books include The Indian Idea of Freedom and Mahatma Gandhi, Nonviolent Power in Action. And what fascinates me and perplexes me about Gandhi's attitude toward nonviolence is that he was, of course, nonviolent outwardly, but he was also nonviolent inwardly, and his attitude toward his opposition, toward his foe, was really quite profound. Could you talk about what his attitude was toward the British government, toward the British officials, whoever he was trying to persuade to do something?
This is an attitude that's extremely important, and you're right to underline it. It is fascinating, and it's at the center of his concepts, and it links his thought with Martin Luther King Jr. very importantly, as I'm sure Professor Carson will want to comment on later on. At any rate, Gandhi distinguished between two concepts which he originated, the idea of satyagraha, which I've already mentioned, and that is a nonviolence of a kind that is so complete and so total and so personal that he took it as a creed that applied to himself, and he insisted that if one were a true satyagrahi, then one would practice nonviolence in such a complete manner that he or she would experience no anger towards an adversary, no hatred, no ill will. And so he insisted that there must be no physical violence, of course, towards the adversary, but equally there must be no violence of spirit, that is, no psychological violence, no harboring attitudes of enmity or ill will. And he distinguished between that, satyagraha, and duragraha. Duragraha was a kind of nonviolence that he had seen practiced all over the world, and he saw that as a corrupt, a counterfeit form of nonviolence. And it was that kind of nonviolence that he called passive resistance. And he put it down, he criticized it as a wrong form of nonviolence. Now, that kind of nonviolence, duragraha, would allow for enmity and ill will, hatred, bitterness towards the adversary. It was a kind of nonviolence that was nonviolent in terms of its physical nature. That is, there would be no hitting or in any way aiming of physical weapons towards the adversary. However, that kind of nonviolence, duragraha, was corrupt because it would allow for hatred and ill will and enmity. So that form, he argued, must be purged from a nonviolent movement. There must be no attitude of mind that would allow for this violence of the spirit. And it's that which, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. does develop, and in a very important way.
Now, another concept we hear a lot in connection with Gandhi, alongside satyagraha, which you've mentioned is holding fast to truth, is swaraj, and maybe you can correct my pronunciation, which is loosely defined as freedom, and maybe you could talk about what that component of Gandhi's thought meant.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that, because I think that it's extremely important in terms of his original contribution. I see Gandhi as making two key contributions to political thinking in the 20th century. One is satyagraha, or the power of nonviolence, but the other you mentioned is swaraj, and swaraj means freedom or liberty or liberation or emancipation. And his argument was that India must use the power of nonviolence in order to achieve its freedom. However, he interpreted freedom in an important manner, and an original way. He said that the kind of freedom that we associate with Western thinking, that is, freedom as liberty, freedom to do as you wish, that kind of freedom was only license, and India would not have achieved its fullest realization of self if it had achieved freedom in only that way. That kind of freedom meant just getting the British out of India. It was not complete. The complete form of freedom that he wanted was a psychological form of freedom that would liberate Indians completely from any sense of inferiority, from the whole colonial mentality, that is, the way in which imperialism had seeped into their being. That kind of freedom was an emancipation of spirit. And so it was not enough just to get the British out of India. We had to get the British mentality out of our minds and our spirits to emancipate ourselves truly in that spiritual or psychological sense. That was the meaning of Swaraj.
So in other words, gaining independence through violent means would for Gandhi be a betrayal, a loss of spirit, and therefore wouldn't really be worth it in the long run.
Precisely. That is exactly it. Because the means are related to the end. We reap as we sow. And if we practice violence, then we won't be able to get that complete freedom that we're aiming at, that is, the psychological or spiritual emancipation of a people.
Now, all of this would be profound enough, except that Gandhi actually tried to practice what he preached, what he taught, what he learned, what he developed over his lifetime. And in your book, Mahatma Gandhi, Nonviolent Power and Action, you focus on two critical episodes in Gandhi's career, the Great Salt March of 1930, that was protesting the government's salt monopoly. And then there was Gandhi's fast about 17 years later against the Hindu-Muslim riots in the city of Calcutta. Why did you decide to focus on these two events, and what do they say about how Gandhi practiced what he talked about?
Well, you've sure done your homework, C.S., on this, and I appreciate your raising that. I looked at Gandhi's whole life, and I was trying to find examples that represented his most stellar achievements, that is, examples that would show how he had succeeded in administering nonviolence and in a way that was truly exemplary of his highest achievements. And so I selected these two because I felt that they were complementary. The first, as you said, in 1930, his Salt March, was an act of mass civil disobedience against the British rule in India. And it was extraordinarily successful. It was an amazing event, and as a result of that, Time magazine named Gandhi Man of the Year, and the whole world looked to him as a practitioner of nonviolence. It was because of that, I think, more than any other act, that the British determined that they were no longer wanted in India, and they could no longer make their colonial rule work.
And this was, again, a march to the sea, a long march to the sea, where Indians would gather salt in a violation of the government monopoly on salt production.
Precisely. Uh-huh. Gandhi seized on the salt tax because it influenced everyone. Everyone used salt, and Indian could relate to it. And while the British tax on salt was not as extreme or great as the tax, say, on property, nevertheless, unlike the tax on property, it touched every Indian. And Gandhi wanted to be inclusive in the movement, to find an issue to which everyone could relate. And so he marched with a group of 80 of his associates or followers over a period of 24 days, approximately 240 miles, to the seacoast and manufactured salt, natural salt, at the seacoast, western seacoast of India, in defiance of the British tax on salt. He used that salt. However, as one of Gandhi's followers said, we're not manufacturing salt here primarily. We're manufacturing civil disobedience. It was that act, that symbolic act, that turned the country on.
Interesting. And then the famous fast in 1947, when there was massive Hindu-Muslim riots in Calcutta, and Gandhi, as during much of his career, was trying to prevent violence.
Right. He wanted to show that nonviolence could work, and work dramatically, in a highly violent situation. And so, as you just said, this was in the midst of the civil war that followed India's independence in 1947. This occurred in September of 1947, whereas India got its independence in August of 1947. So it occurred 3 weeks after, and Gandhi used the technique of the fast to try to bring the Muslims and the Hindus of Calcutta to their senses, and he succeeded dramatically.
Gandhi must have known, for example, you were talking earlier about no anger, no enmity, no sense of internal violence. He must have known that people who engaged in nonviolent actions, even the closest followers of his, could not perhaps reach the same kind of religious or philosophical purity that Gandhi did. So how did he deal with the fact that here he is, a man of principle, acting in a certain way, and yet he has these mass actions where people, his followers, participants in marches or protests might not necessarily feel the same way he does?
Gandhi was a realist as well as an idealist. He used to call himself a practical idealist, meaning that he was highly aware of practical situations and made his nonviolence work in, as I said, the midst of violent situations. So he was well aware that people were not able to achieve the same degree of creedal nonviolence, that is, a commitment to nonviolence, that he did. But he was very careful in his actions, too, to select out very consciously those who had achieved this. For example, the 1930 Salt March. He was accompanied, as I said, by 80 people. All of those 80 people had lived in his ashram, in his spiritual retreat in Ahmedabad, for at least a year before they accompanied him on the march. Now, during that time, they had submitted to the most rigorous kind of discipline. That is, in terms of diet, control over themselves. In every way, they were extremely disciplined individuals. And he wanted to be sure, when he took those 80 people with him on the march, that he had individuals that would not strike back, that would not use violence if provoked. And he could be sure, because these people had been through a rigorous training. And he would not accept others who were not. And his argument was that if I take these people on the march, then I can be sure that there will be no violence, at least among those people setting the initial example. And so he believed that if he set that pure example in a powerful way, then that would turn others to it, and others would emulate that example. That was his technique, education through that kind of demonstration.
And, of course, one example of setting an example was the fast in 1947, as you were saying. Tell me, what kind of reaction did that have in the hearts and minds of not only his followers, but people who were wreaking havoc in cities throughout India?
Well, it was able to control the city of Calcutta remarkably well. He was not able to contain the violence that extended throughout the whole of northern India and resulted in a horrendous civil war. But in this city of Calcutta, it was quite remarkable. The city had been completely engulfed in violence from August 1946 until he began the fast in, as I said, September of 47. And he confronted, therefore, a most volatile situation, an explosive situation in which Hindus and Muslims, a very large Hindu majority there in Calcutta, tormenting, persecuting the Muslims, then the Muslims striking back, so the two of them engaged in this. And after fasting for 3 days, Gandhi managed to generate within the city a tremendously civil reaction, and that civil reaction spread so that Calcutta, peace came to Calcutta. They did not want Gandhi to die. They saw him as a person of great spiritual worth and a person who was willing to sacrifice himself for them. And whereas they thought before he came to the city that it was in their interests to hurt others, as a result of what he did, of putting his life on the line in a nonviolent way, they came to believe that it was in their interest to act in a peaceful manner, and peace came to Calcutta and stayed there. Now, it was not true in other cities that Gandhi was unable to visit. For example, in the Punjab, where there was terrible violence in 46 and 47. But he went then after Calcutta to Delhi, and another story that I didn't tell in my book was the way in which he used a fast in Delhi to bring peace to that city. However, he was assassinated in January of 1948 following that fast by a Hindu who believed that he was too tolerant of Muslims, and he shot Gandhi, killed him. because of that. He felt that Gandhi was so soft on the Muslims that the Muslims would take over India, even though they were in a minority, if Gandhi continued in this way. So the Delhi fast itself was successful, but then the assassination, and it was his assassination ultimately that ended civil war in India, because Hindus were so shamed by the fact that one of their own had murdered him that they, in a massive act of guilt, renounced violence, and that ended the civil war. It was one of those few cases that I know where an assassination of a major political figure had a highly beneficial effect and stopped the violence rather than promoting it.
Dennis Dalton teaches political science at Barnard College, and he has written and spoken extensively on Gandhi. You are listening to an archived presentation of a discussion about the theory and practice of nonviolence, according to Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi. We shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. Those are words from a sermon by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called Loving Your Enemies. My second guest is Claiborne Carson. He is professor of history at Stanford University. He directs the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project. He is co-editor of the papers of Martin Luther King Jr. And I want to welcome you, Clay. And before we talk about what seems logical, which is the extent to which Dr. King was influenced by Gandhi, you have written that even before King's ascendancy, there was a well-established Black Gandhian tradition, African-American Gandhian tradition, and maybe you could talk about this, because maybe a lot of people don't know about Gandhi in African-American society before Dr. King.
Well, certainly there was a long-established tradition going back to really the early years of the Gandhian movement in India. You see it, lots of evidence of it, black newspapers who reported about what was going on in India. You see indications from the trips that a number of African-American leaders, you know, Howard Thurmond, Benjamin Mays, you know, there were numerous people who went to India to study the movement firsthand and brought back and came back and did lecture tours and brought word of it. In fact, on one occasion in the 40s, Martin Luther King went and listened to a lecture by a black leader who had just returned from India. This tradition was pretty well established, and there were a number of people like Mays who would give speeches in which they talked about the possible application of Gandhian ideas in the United States.
And Mays, Benjamin Mays, he was the president of Morehouse College,
That's right.
Dr. King attended in the 1940s. And so King heard Mays talk about his trips to India. Was this the first kind of exposure that King had to Gandhi's ideas?
It could have been, but, you know, again, these ideas were so current in the black community that he might well have heard about it through his father's church. You know, there were people who were talking about the implications of the Gandhian movement for African Americans, and there were articles written about it, as I said, back as early as the 1920s. So this was not something that would have taken a person as curious and as, well-informed as Martin Luther King a great deal of trouble to discover.
So what was the mainstream, if you will, conception of the implications of Gandhi's thought for the African-American struggle? And how did Dr. King expand on that, revitalize it, or take it to another level, which he most certainly did?
Well, I think that, first of all, the influence came from the notion that Gandhi was using it successfully. If Gandhi had simply flopped and not been able to have any impact in India, I don't think the influence would have been as great. But the very fact that here was a movement of non-white people taking on, at that time, you know, Britain is certainly the leading empire in the world, and if not succeeding immediately, but at least keeping the battle going. That was a source of inspiration for anyone who looked at it. I think that for King, though, what was interesting and intriguing about the Gandhian movement is it resolved a question he had had about pacifism. I would certainly agree with Professor Dalton's remarks about the importance of Gandhi and moving beyond passive resistance or pacifism. I think that when King first heard about pacifism, I think he responded skeptically because he did not see how pacifism could overcome evil. You know, it seemed like throwing weakness against strength. And only his understanding of the Gandhian struggle gave him an awareness that perhaps what might seem to be weakness could be turned, if you turned it into a mass movement, if you used it aggressively, if you developed certain kinds of techniques that Gandhi refined, then it might be a powerful force. And it made much more sense to use a powerful force against the power of evil in the world. But even then, I think King really came to his understanding of Gandhian resistance only after the Montgomery bus boycott began.
Claiborne Carson, he is a professor of history at Stanford.